I find out where you guys are each from and whether or not you all know each other. We're not a huge group, so we might as well be friendly. So can we just go from the front through the rows and just maybe your name and anything that identifies you in the community here? Yeah, so please. Right, cool. Thanks, Jono. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. For a number of decades.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Oh, Jeff. So we're going. Yep. That's it. Yeah. Cool. Cheers, Steve. Yep. Oh, true as well. Fantastic. Great. Your name, sorry, was Ed. Yeah, and excellent. Go, Diane. Yeah. In this church. Wow. Hard case. Great. Yes. Great. Yeah. Good on your path. Thanks for turning up. You represent them all. Yeah. So over here, family. Yeah. Fantastic. Oh, good to see you. Yeah. And yeah. Oh, fantastic. Okay, well, welcome. Good to see you. Do you want to introduce yourself, Sophie? Yeah, very good. Okay. Well, I was just thinking to bring kind of a bit of an overview message just from the Word and then into conversational skills today. So I'll just do that maybe at some reasonable speed and then just open it up for Q&A. I think whatever's most practical to help us in our conversations is going to be what's most important. I think what I'd like to pass on is maybe just some reflections on Jesus that give us permission to engage different people in conversation very differently. In fact, to not even talk to some people, to not even reply questions to others, and to learn the wisdom and the tact of replying questions with questions and even hiding our opinions. I think this is all part of the conversational skill set for our day. At the same time, we have a message we want to communicate, so it's about working out the balances by which we hold all of those things together. So I hope it'll be interesting. Our nation's facing some good stuff and some bad stuff all concurrently. Some of the really positive things I see happening around the country, I think the teaching of conversational skills is rather important, in my view. I think if the New Zealand church as a whole was to establish just five things that we'd all do in common to try and help us in the public square, I think the teaching of conversational skills through every pulpit, every year, every youth ministry, every year would have to be one of those things. We've got a society that's becoming hostile toward us. What's encouraging is that there are hundreds of churches that are now doing this. So if we look at things over 10 and 20 year time periods, 10 years ago, conversational outreach was not taught in pulpits in New Zealand, and actually neither was any kind of evangelism training. Evangelism training 10 years ago, and our thinking in New Zealand was in seminars. That's changed in the last 10 years. And so hundreds of pastors now teach conversational outreach through pulpits. And churches partnered with us. For example, last year we could measure 57,000 Christians equipped in that year by their pastor through the weekend church services. Another thing that's happening that's really positive is that the same is happening amongst youth. So I think that youth ministry in New Zealand is in a bit of a free fall. It's decreasing and collapsing at an astronomical rate. And I am despairing at how few are willing to engage a strategic conversation about what we do about this. We actually need a united solution as the church. Staying in our partisan groups to try and sustain youth ministries in the provinces just isn't working as an approach anymore. But in the midst of that, we identified that youth were getting hammered in their schools and were unable to engage conversations because if they out themselves as Christian, they're immediately thought to be a prejudicial, judgmental kind of person. So we put together a website, godtalk.nz. We created a range of youth leadership and youth discussion resources, all based around 5-minute videos with discussion guides. 1,200 different youth or youth leaders visit that website per month. So somehow in the mix, even though there's a lack of momentum in things, there are people who are actually engaging with that substance. So I think that's a trend which we can look at positively. Another one that I think is positive is the Hope Project booklet delivery. So we did 6 efforts that were with a paid delivery, largely because pastors' groups didn't want to be responsible for the delivery. We then ended up a bit shy of funds, and I think the Lord was in that, and our board actually thought the same. So we made a strategic decision last year. So, hey, kia ora, how's it going? Hey. So we made a strategic decision as a board to make the delivery volunteer-based last year, and we didn't have a clue how it would go. Because if you can imagine trying to get a favorable connection right across the country, we selected every city or town of 5,000 or more people. And it was a case of the booklets are available, you deliver or they don't get delivered. And you don't have to deliver them. It's not manipulation, but it's just a boundary because we have no other financial choice. They were basically delivered the whole country. There were a couple of pockets of your own city not done. There were pockets of central Wellington not done because the coordinator got genuinely ill. So his coordination fell over for very legitimate reasons. To throw the boast, Auckland was done. 347,000 eligible letterboxes for that delivery were all delivered while pre-walking along streets. So the church in New Zealand showed itself to be ready to unite behind outreach strategies that they feel are suitable for them, that are maybe sensible and sit within the scope of what everybody could potentially agree upon. So I thought that was really positive. So, hey, kia ora, welcome. G'day. But I think there's some negative ones that are sitting here as well, and some negative trends, and you'll probably see them as well. When the abortion bill was pushed through this past year, it was done so by government, I felt, with some kind of collusion from media, not telling the public about what was going on. It's one of the most atrocious abortion bills that exists on the planet, completely denying the rights of children right up to the point of birth. That was wrong. Also, both our Labour and their national governments have pushed through laws against the will of the people after citizen-initiated referendum. So that includes, I think, the legalisation of prostitution, and it also included the no-smacking law, which 87% of our nation was against, and which history since has shown made no difference at all. Violence against children, sexual abuse against children, increased by about 50% in both those categories in the following decade after that law. And so what we're seeing is the demise of our democracy and of accountability within government to actually listen to the will of the people. The hate speech laws that are proposed are incredibly dangerous, and the Christian church as a whole can expect to have decent challenges with those in due time if they are passed. And the challenge is that if a government's deciding to pass things without regard for the will of the people, then it's possible that they're passed irrespective of any conversation that happens. This makes the question of what we are to do rather difficult. Public ignorance on the referendum that we had through was actually quite concerning as well. The neutral government website, in my opinion, was far from neutral and didn't present both sides of the arguments. So you kind of had a very lopsided promotion as the neutral communication. So imagine how things got when they were biased. So they were biased, sort of proven in the analysis after it, in the case of cannabis. The overall media, 50 agencies' presentation, though, of the euthanasia things wasn't so biased. They did give both sides of that argument a fair hearing. We've also got a big problem coming, I think, as a culture, in that the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, which was in 1948, it guaranteed the freedom of religion, but also that a person shouldn't be discriminated against because of their race, the colour of their skin, their sex, their ethnicity, their culture, their something, and anything else. So it's got the statement, it's got the word sex in there, and it's got the word or anything else sitting in the scope of that. So that's the only reference to all the sexual stuff in it. Regarding religion, it says that a person has a right to choose their religion and to express it individually or in a group, and in private or in public, and the freedom to change their religion. So that's what we were guaranteed. And in essence, Eleanor Roosevelt, who chaired the committee that put it together, was putting Christian values into a Declaration of Human Rights, but removing the word God. And it's in this context that some secular academics have even recognized that by this means, secularism has become but a footnote to the Bible, to quote one academic. In other words, biblical values were embraced as the values of secularism, which by itself has no values other than survival of the fittest, which is an ethic of power. And it's made a remarkable difference in the world as a result, bringing incredible good, which the United Nations has done. The challenge is that where views on sex and what sexual freedoms should be have begun to diversify, it's diversified to a point where some groups don't just want to be free to do what they want to do, they want you to agree. And there's a really big difference between respecting a person's right to do something and agreeing with the morality of what they are doing. So the very word tolerance, to be tolerant doesn't mean we agree. To be tolerant means that we treat each other well, irrespective of how much we disagree. So I think that the best outcome for New Zealand and for other Western civilizations, which are firmly based on the Judeo-Christian way of thinking, the best outcome is that we actually become tolerant societies. That should be the goal. The grave danger we have is that I think we're heading in a direction of being intolerant societies, because there's going to be a dogma, like a liturgical religious creed. And if you will not tick off on that and sort of bow down to it and say, yes, I agree with all of those things, then you'll be blacklisted. And that's where hate speech laws begin to come in, even as a tool to punish those who won't comply. So it's a process that's happening all around us. It's been going for years. It's happened in 60 countries last century where religious freedoms and other freedoms were literally lost in totality. So there's nothing new about what we're looking at. It's in the history books if we take the time to read. We've lost our moral compass, and it's leaving us in a very vulnerable position. And so you've got Christian believers who are thinking right across the nation, struggling to know how to interpret the news every day. Because there's things that are reported, which are partly true. So you can't just say that's not true, but they're also partly loaded with an agenda, and they're reporting one side, and they're taking sources from a news media overseas, which is clearly only one side of an argument. And we've got a growing public body who are therefore ill-informed. For a democracy to sustain, it needs people who are informed and intelligent, but also engaged. In other words, they have to have the information, they have to intelligently engage with the information, but they have to intelligently engage in the democratic process. What we have is we're losing the freedom of information. And without the information, it doesn't matter how intelligent a person is. They're arguing something, absolutely believing it, on the basis of limited information. And so it's a slippery slide. Well, it doesn't have to be a slippery slide. It's not the best situation. So what's the way forward in this? Obviously, the way that we engage in the public square has to adapt. And I would encourage that light shines the brightest in the darkness. So for the Christian church, nothing I said just then is actually a threat to us. The Christian church isn't this building. This isn't the church. The people are the church. And the people can exist as the church with or without the building. And history demonstrates well that the Christian church will grow the most, in fact, when it's suffering some level of persecutions. Also, Christianity has categorically changed the world. It's done it before, it can do it again. So there's no situation that we're walking into that is probably going to be anywhere near as bad as other places that exist in the world today. And also, there's nothing to say that it can't be reversed if God, by his Spirit, brings our nation back to find its moral compass from which to bring a moral accountability for right and wrong in what we do for the protection of people. So how do we engage? We need conversational skills. And we've looked at Jesus through the lenses of a truth-based society. You're not going to stop me saying what I believe. You know, I'm not scared of what they say. I'm just going to state what I believe. And we go out to share the gospel and we tell people they need Jesus because they're sinners. And it's possible that we just completely miss our culture because it's changed. Just to state what you believe could be foolish. You could dig a hole for yourself that you'll fall into and get buried. So we'll look at Jesus on that. To state a gospel that tries to convince someone they're a sinner so they understand why they need Jesus might miss the point that they don't even believe God exists in the first place. And in our culture, it might actually miscommunicate. They might think God's some, you know, conniving little God who's picking up on little things and judging everybody, really pedantic about sin. He is, but we might have miscommunicated. He's a God of love. And so communication isn't just the words we say. Communication is the sentiment and the heart that we embody within a message. And if the way we communicate leaves people with an impression that God's really judgmental, which some of the traditional methods actually have in today's world, we've miscommunicated. So we need to adjust. So let's have a read on the screen here if you want to bring that up. We've got the conversational skills of Jesus, looking at John 8, 1 to 11, the woman caught in adultery. Then they all went home, but Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. At dawn he appeared again in the temple courts, and all the people gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded to stone such a woman. Now what do you say?" They were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him. But Jesus bent down and started writing on the ground with his finger. When they kept questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "Let any of you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." Again he stooped down and wrote on the ground. At this, those who heard began to go away, one at a time, the older first, until only Jesus was left with the woman still standing there. Jesus straightened up and asked her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said. "Then neither do I condemn you," Jesus declared. "Now go and leave your life of sin." In this passage, we see Jesus engaging with three different people or groups of people. The way he engaged was different. The way we engage people depends on the audience. And the dynamics of a conversation have a lot to do with the freedom of a conversation. Sometimes the dynamics of a conversation are going to be awkward. It should never be free. We should be pulling out. Sometimes the dynamics will be awkward because we've broken a rule of communication and we're becoming too pushy, in which case they will be awkward and the conversation's actually already over, even though it appears to continue. All right? So the dynamics of the conversation, the freedom of the conversation, has a lot to do with the dynamics. Jesus is sitting with the crowds. They are interested. It would seem that Jesus is reasonably open with them. Next, the mood changes. You've got the religious leaders turning up, and they're wanting to trap Jesus. Jesus ceases being open. All right? Then the religious leaders leave, and you've only got the woman there with the crowd. So note the crowd is still listening in. And Jesus engages very gently with the woman. And I think, I don't know if it was Martin Luther who said, or could have been Augustine, that grace to the humble, law to the proud. Just a very simple principle. This woman is there in humility. There's only one person there who could have condemned her who was without sin, and that was Jesus. But Jesus said, "I don't condemn you." And why? Because it was unjust not to condemn her, because a good God must see that justice is done. And I would simply suggest that Jesus knew that he was on his way to the cross, where he would pay for the sin of that woman, and justice would be served. And maybe it would be that in 2 or 3 years' time, she would hear about that, and who knows what God would do in her heart at that point in time. To me, the most exciting part of the story is where the news media come in, and it's on TV News Live. And they come in and they say, "We've caught this woman in the act of adultery. Jesus, what do you say?" And they thrust the microphone into his face. It's incredibly intense. And I don't know if you ever sort of think, "Man, I hope I never get caught out in some situation with a terrible question in front of a lot of people." Well, that's what Jesus has got right here. How's Jesus going to respond? What Jesus does is refuses to speak. And if you can excuse me dramatizing this for a minute, no disrespect to Jesus, just imagine the scenario. They ask Jesus a question: "What should we do with this woman? Because the law says that she should be stoned." "Come on, Jesus, answer our question." "Jesus, this is TV News Live. Could you please answer? We've got audiences that are waiting." "Come on, Jesus. Why won't you answer the question? Are you scared? Are you a chicken? You're down on the ground, pecking in the ground because you're trying to be a chicken or something? Because you certainly look like one. Aren't you brave enough just to stand up? Man up, Jesus. Man up and tell us what you think. Come on, have some courage, have some backbone. A man of the truth and a teacher of the law shouldn't be embarrassed about the truth he believes in. So stand up and tell us the truth, Jesus. What should we do? Imagine the scenario. In one of the Bible versions, it actually uses the words, because they pressed him for an answer, Jesus stood up and said. And then what he said, of course, was with the wisdom that I think only God can give, and God can give it. And he said to him, whoever's without sin, cast the first stone, and the rest we understand. Jesus couldn't answer the question, firstly, because if he said to give the death sentence, they were under a Roman occupation. So they had no authority to give the death sentence. I don't know if the Pharisees would then have actually stoned the woman or not, but in either case, Jesus would have been responsible or could be accused of giving an instruction that was contrary to the Roman law, which could get you killed in those days. On the other hand, if Jesus said not to stone the woman, he would have been contradicting the law, wouldn't he? And also, she justly deserved to be stoned, as does every single one of us, and as did every single person who was standing there, with one exception, that being Jesus. A second reason I think Jesus didn't answer was because there was hypocrisy present. Those who were accusing her had also sinned. Maybe it is that some of those who were accusing her had also committed adultery, so they're trying to get her stoned for a sin that they have also committed. A third reason is that there was a gross injustice standing right in front of them. Here's this woman being marauded in front of a crowd, being embarrassed and shamed and humiliated as a pawn in their game, with no concern for her and with the absence of the man that she was caught in the act of adultery with. Where's the man? So there was something going on in this picture that wasn't quite right. I think it's an interesting reflection to ask, was Jesus scared of answering the question? I think we all know the answer is no. But if you think about yourself being caught in a situation, if TV news came in right now to ask you an opinion on a controversial topic, you might have butterflies jumping through your heart, right? Sort of, whew, what do I say? A little bit short of oxygen. The brain sort of going into a spin. Jesus was the most fully human who has ever lived, with the exception partially, you could say, of Adam and Eve. Because I think Adam and Eve were also fully human and free, as Jesus was. The rest of us are corrupted by the human nature. Jesus, when he met a person, was 100% present with them. He wasn't thinking with concern of what was happening in 10 minutes and in 4 hours' time. He wasn't suffering anxiety or processing bad emotion from yesterday in the same way we might. Because his fully human, healthy dynamic enabled him to process those things, probably with a freedom that we simply never experience within this life. I don't think Jesus was quiet at all because of fear. So let's come to a paradigm then. If we bring up the three next points. Yeah, thank you, Zach. And we need a lens to interpret Scripture, and we've interpreted Scripture through this lens of a free society where we try to proclaim the truth to others in the hope that they become free. Well, the society no longer believes our truth. They think that all religions are the same. They think that religious truth doesn't exist, moral truth doesn't exist, and in fact, truth itself is questionable. We don't know if that even exists, because in actual fact, you can question whether rationality exists, which means you can question whether free will exists and consciousness exists, or is our consciousness just an illusion? So philosophically, once you step away from Christianity, you're actually in a quagmire if you want to engage that conversation. Jesus engaged with the interested openly. But when he was with the disinterested, he didn't. He only intrigued. When he was with the hostile, he fended them off. It's a pretty important thing for us to note, because we've been trained to be open and honest about everything, because this is a Christian nation and we're out there to tell the truth. No, this isn't a Christian nation like that anymore, even though our values predominantly still are. Our freedoms of speech and religion are in danger of sort of going out the window, in fact. Jesus lived in a hostile environment, and he related differently to different people. We need to get the lenses on to start to read the Gospels afresh and to consider this. Jesus was open when he discussed things with his disciples behind closed doors. It says in the Scriptures that he explained all things to them. This included explaining all of the parables and their meaning. That, of course, is a relevant point, because when he was with the crowds, Jesus never explained the meanings of the parables. We often miss that because we think of parables as beautiful illustrations to try and make God's teaching points clear. Illustrations from the natural world around us. How many times have we all heard that or said that? No, parables to crowds were a means of obscuring the truth. That puts it negatively, but it makes the point. They were a means of hiding what Jesus was actually saying. They were a means of sifting audiences so that those who were genuinely interested could try and think through and discern and discover the truth. And Jesus, we know this because Jesus said to, was disappointed that his disciples needed the parables to be explained. So Jesus expected his disciples to be able to work it out for themselves. In other words, the parables could be understood by members of the crowd if they had discerning minds and open hearts. But for a person who was only kind of a bit disinterested in spiritual things, maybe just looking for some entertainment, maybe Jesus to heal a blind person or something else fun like that, they just wouldn't do the hard work to understand the parables. While for the hostile elements of the crowd who were trying to catch Jesus out in his words, which is like one or two people in an office conversation anywhere you go these days, or a bunch of students, one or two, there's always going to be a hostile prism now. The parables simply didn't give the quotable quote. They didn't give Jesus saying something as a propositional truth statement that they could then write down and leverage to use against him at a later date. And the day of us just speaking openly about every topic and stating our opinions, I personally think is over. We've got to be wise as serpents, harmless as doves. And that statement is given in a context of there are hostile people out there with ill intent. You need to be wise. So be wise as serpents and as harmless as doves. Do not throw your pearl to the swine. What does it mean? It means that someone asks you a question about spiritual things and you discern that they're not actually interested. So you just choose not to even answer their question. And that sounds funny from a culture where we're supposed to explain the truth. Someone asks, of course we will answer. Well, I don't know, good teacher, should we pay taxes to Caesar? Because that's no longer someone who's disinterested, that's someone who's hostile. Jesus replies the question with a question. Show me a coin. Actually, he starts off by calling their bluff. Why are you trying to trap me? He's not just nice Jesus, meek and mild. He discerns the ill intent and he calls their bluff. Why are you trying to trap me? Then, he says, show me a coin. Grain on the Sabbath, there's two examples in Luke 6 of that, where Jesus is being picked on for his behavior on the Sabbath, not following all the customs that they wanted him to cover. Have a look at how he responds, because it's different in each case. Because there's no set formula, there's no one way of sharing the gospel. There's no two conversations that are ever the same. Every conversation is different because every person is different. It's always about connecting as a human being to another human being, discovering the God potential and beauty within them, but trying to discover where their mind and their heart is at to encourage them a step toward Jesus. So we come to an application then, and three simple points just real quick. I'll give you two stories and we'll open for just Q&A or thoughts. First encouragement is for you to ask, who is it that you could engage with more? Who could you ask questions of more? Who could you make a provocative statement to or an intriguing statement to try and open a conversation up? Think about your conversations with neighbors and with family and friends, with colleagues or schoolmates or people on a university campus. But then think about society, the issues of council, moral issues of our nation, national political type issues, justice issues, welfare issues. If the Christian church and Christian believers don't speak up and engage, then our voice will be silenced out. The freedoms of speech and religion are a case of use it or lose it. The way to preserve our freedoms is actually to use them. We have to engage conversations. What we need to do is to practice really hard the skills of conversation, to not give quotable quotes and not say things, to reply questions with questions. What an interesting question. So glad you asked. That's a really great question. I'm not quite sure what to say. What do you think? In other words, just how do you bounce a question back? Why do you ask that? Where'd you get that idea from? Why do you ask that question and not this question? I don't quite understand. I'm not actually convinced we know each other well enough to talk about that one. You know, what can we say in conversations to keep conversations going? See, apologetics traditionally is about presenting arguments for faith, right? Arguments or reasons in favor of why we might believe this faith to be true. We all know already, but let's be reminded, the goal isn't to win arguments, but to win people. Winning people has a lot of soft skills to it. It's not just about the hard skills. It's about the love of the heart. And I'd say the love of the heart and the wisdom God gives us, that's where conversational skills come from. But if we're going to turn a person, I think we also need knowledge. So you could say there's three components there to really help a person on the journey to Christ. We've got to have authentic love. That's the motive. We need some knowledge because that's going to inform, but we need wisdom. So to give you the two other points here, very simple. What stories can you learn and tell before the two stories? I think that the closest parallel to Jesus' parables in our day is the stories of New Zealand's cultural history. Now, that includes a bicultural story, that sort of side. It also includes a European story, because our predominant laws and culture based on the Ten Commandments and Jesus' law of love come out of England, going back to King Alfred the Great in 810, who made that a foundation for British law and government. We're connected to Christian ethics. Our concepts of charity are from Christianity. Our equality of women came from Christianity. Our equality of the races, the ending of slavery, came from Christianity. Te Tiriti o Waitangi wouldn't exist if it wasn't for Christianity laying the foundations and for Christians in Parliament in England who were conniving in the colonial office to try and actually change the future and wanted to help the Māori people not be colonised. So we actually had an anti-colonialistic movement in New Zealand. That's a story that really, really, really needs telling a lot. Because we've got public media and education who don't want to tell these stories because it doesn't suit their narrative. Because their narrative is to say that we're a free, modern, liberal, secular society. But the truth is that we are firmly founded in the Christian ethic and values as a nation. So if you study our history and look at it and look at the choices that people made and what guided and shaped these amazing, remarkable things, you find Jesus. His footprints are everywhere through that story. We need to tell that story. If you are given a platform to speak to a bunch of non-church people in your workplace, your community, wherever it is that you're engaged, may we all be engaged somewhere, please. We've got to have the wisdom to know what to say. And sometimes even the mention of the name of Jesus is enough to have people's hairs going up on the back of their necks and tension coming into the room. It can really be that tense. We need to sometimes do what Jesus did and start using parables. And so you're in a context, you could almost pick the topic. You're in a context related to education, in which case just say, look, hey, thanks for giving me 5 minutes just to talk about the importance of education. Do you know where the idea came from? To educate poor people, because that was actually a joke in history. Only the rich would have education from private tutors in their homes. The idea actually came out of the Christian Reformation. And John Calvin in particular. And we give education even to poor children originally so that there would be the freedom of religion. Because the Catholic Church had become corrupted, people weren't able to read the Bible. They could never know what the Bible said to make a free and informed decision. So John Calvin worked out that unless we taught literacy to everybody, they couldn't read a Bible for themselves to be free to make a religious decision for themselves. So therefore, that led to the missionary movement, the transcribing of languages, of course, the sharing of a lot of technologies and education and math and science, but also access to the Bible, and that's how we got education. So you could give a story like that. The first schools in New Zealand were missionary schools. They were teaching Māori in Te Reo Māori in a Māori world. The Māori teaching only stopped because the Crown said to, and just incidentally, the missionaries rebelled against the Crown, and then they kind of rebelled against Bishop Selwyn, because they said, we're not here to colonise this nation, and we're not here to serve your agendas, and they kept teaching Māori in Te Reo Māori. You get through to the 1890s, though, any Māori student who used any word of Te Reo Māori in a school could get a cane on the hand for using a single word. So we were totally colonised. But there was actually a good education. In the beginning, Māori actually taught literacy to each other right through New Zealand. It was quite a remarkable thing. But if you see, by knowing those stories, you can present a history that just tells the history without an agenda to really communicate the gospel or anything. But you've got innuendos toward Christianity that put building blocks in place to suddenly realize how fundamental the Christian faith is to who we are as a nation. We are one of the most free, prosperous, and equality-based nations, not just in the world today, but in all of human history. We have no idea what an amazing place this actually is to live. We are free, we are equality-based, and we are unbelievably prosperous. Most people in the poor of the world would beg to try and be a poor person in New Zealand, where you get given money, right? We have no idea how good we actually have it. Why? How did we get to be like that? There's a history behind that. The last thing I would say is, who can you support as an application? Because we need to have a few hundred thousand Christians equipped by their church leaders to engage everyday conversations and keep feeding that culture. But we're also going to need some individuals who are going to be quirky in whatever way, who are going to become key voices to larger audiences or in key areas of society. I believe that God's leadership structure for the church as a whole, the United Church, is that he raises up different people at different times for different things. We don't appoint them. We can appoint, we have the authority to prayerfully appoint leadership in local churches, but we don't get to appoint the church leader in charge of Dunedin or in charge of New Zealand. God doesn't want a king appointed like in the book of Judges, right? You can appoint leaders in your tribes, you can appoint leaders in your cities, you have no authority to appoint a king. God says, I am your king. And the New Testament church is exactly the same. So God will appoint and raise up different people. Our job is to discern that and to support them. And I just suggest that for us to engage well in our society, we need the 200, 300,000 individuals engaging wisely in social media and conversations and newspapers and with politicians. But we're going to need those 20 or 40 key individuals who find platforms to speak to larger audiences on our behalf. They are going to need our support. They won't get funding through the denominational structures of the church. They're going to need support from God's people, from the church as a whole, capital C church. And so that's a part of what we need to do into the future. Two stories to finish. We'll go to Q&A. That'll do us. Just for two comparative stories, I think sometimes we wonder if our conversations are worth it and if we're really making a difference. I've got a friend I've known for 10 years since moving to Tauranga. And I've been just prayerfully seeking God, give me opportunities to encourage hope and faith in this man. He is an atheist, and I respect his freedom of will to be an atheist. That's his choice. But I feel that he is lacking in hope, and I think that that is evident in his actions and his behavior. And he's trying to convince himself he's living the great life, but I'm not at all convinced that that's the case. He's a kind-hearted guy. He's not a bad man by any extent, you know, by earthly standards. But, you know, to try and communicate the Christian faith is awfully difficult. And whenever we have got near the Christian faith, he is so angry at the church. He actually just goes red-faced and he takes off. He is uncontrolled. He's lost control. And his emotions take over. You get anywhere near something that triggers what's going on inside his head from his previous experience, and boom, he's gone. He's incapable of a rational conversation. He fuzzes out and he's away. And you just have to let him go and smile and use your people skills to not engage. You have to answer questions that he'll ask you in the midst of that by not answering them or replying them with questions. Because there's no point feeding that. It's not going to go anywhere. We want to win people, not arguments. All I managed to do in my most recent conversation, I was delighted, an hour and a half conversation, was share a personal story. It's really all I got through. And I shared about a time in my life where I suffered significant anxiety. I come from quite a diverse family background. And in my 30s, it all caught up with me. I was phenomenally disappointed with God. And I worked out at the bottom of it that I could either be angry at God for the rest of my life, or I could choose to forgive God for what I perceived him not to have done as I wanted him to, and choose to just trust him no matter what. And so I thought, well, I'll trust you, Lord. Coming out of that, I took 6 years to come through that. But I came through and I found my sense of balance again. And I live with a sense of joy and freedom every day, believing there is a God in heaven who created this earth and who loves me, despite the evil and suffering that I cannot understand, and there is a hope beyond. So I was able to share that with him. I think that's probably the best thing that I shared in this last conversation. It ended with him, of course, joking about how he was going to try and free me from the bondages of religion that I was still entrapped underneath. But, you know, that's just how it goes as I climbed back over the fence, and back to my own property. Sometimes you've got to wonder. It takes years and years, and you wonder if you're getting anywhere. But I just want to encourage you, every conversation's worth it. I had another guy contact me recently, and this doesn't happen often. His name's David, and we'd conversed about 25 or so years ago. And I'd said various things to him, which I don't even remember saying, about the faith. From then, he had got himself in some trouble. He did some time in prison. And in the midst of all of that, he thought back to those conversations, and he could remember things we said. And just for a little joke on the side, I'd never marry anyone like that, because if they're recalling conversations from 25 years ago and coming back at you, you're going to be in trouble. But That aside, you know, he's following the Lord, and he gave me these very long Facebook messages as a way of actually just saying thank you. That actually spoke to me. God used that. I remembered that. That then came back and was a key part of my decisions to change my life directions. The Lord uses us, and we wish that we could be used more often to share the whole gospel and see a person come to faith in Jesus, or see our children or grandchildren or anything like that. We have to accept that it's one step at a time. We've got to embrace the saying, reach your world one step at a time. Right? Conversations are like adventures. When you begin one, you never know where it will go. You can't control it. You can't always share the gospel. What a silly goal to always share the gospel. No, you'd have to force something on people to achieve that. No. How about you try and find what God's doing? Look for the opportunity and help them take a step closer to Jesus. That might include sharing the gospel. Fantastic. But a step closer to Jesus sometimes is to respect a conversational boundary and say nothing else. And it's the right thing to do. We have to trust God as sovereign. If a couple of 100,000 Christians do that, and if those few 100,000 Christians are praying for God to be working in our nation, and if God's doing his work and raising up crazy individuals to do different things, and the church as a whole is enabling that united function to exist as well, God can yet move in this nation, and we have to hold on to that hope. So I'll leave it there.